Moncrief on News Talk.
Joanna Fortune's with us once again to answer some of your parenting questions. Afternoon@newstalk.com is the address if you'd like to send in questions for Joanna. Afternoon, Joanna.
Afternoon, Sean.
I'm hoping for some advice from my 11-year-old daughter. She's a great kid in many ways, is quite advanced and mature for her age. But I've started to notice the past few months she's developed these tics or habits, like squinting constantly and clearing her throat. She recently told me she has a routine before bedtime that consists of checking things over and over and counting to 10 before finally getting into bed. I've reassured her and told her it's a habit and one we'll work on together and try and break. But to be honest, I've no idea where I should start. She can be anxious at times, especially if starting a new activity or meeting new people. But all of these habits seem to happen at home and in a place of safety and comfort. So really don't know how to help her relax and break them.
Oh, it's interesting. I mean, I think, first of all, you know what this parent is saying? I've no idea where I should start. You have started. You know, she has told you and you've responded appropriately. You've reassured her. You've told her it's a habit. It's something that can be worked on. Mm. Like, that is a great place to start. But as a parent, there are certain things with our children that even if we had a manual, they're just beyond us to fix.
Yeah.
You don't have an answer to this. There's a couple of questions I'd have, though. And I do think, you know, if she and or you, this parent, are open to working with a therapist, you might see a big change quite relatively quickly, do you know, because she is very young. But I am wondering if this little one might be tending towards perfectionistic standards for herself.
Yeah.
You know, so those, you know, when I hear someone who is a great kid and advanced and mature for their age, I'm often thinking that's a child who might be putting themselves, not that the parent's putting them under pressure, but self-oriented perfectionism.
Yeah.
That it's coming from themselves and holding themselves to very high standards. And that desire to please others and to come across as biddable and nice and compliant, the good girl mask, basically. And often when we talk about a mask, it's what's behind the mask that we're looking to get to. And that can come out, whatever it might be, in all kinds of behaviours like this. Things that we think, well, everything is feeling out of my control. But what is control is if I turn that light switch on X amount of times and turn around twice and then get into bed, I'll have a good dream tonight. And even a clever child will often, and I've worked with kids who will say, I know that's not real. Like, I do know that, but I can't not do it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So you get that battle internally between, yeah. And this little one seems to have that because she came to the parent and said, look, I'm doing this. So something in her is recognizing I shouldn't need to do this and I don't want to do it, but I am doing it. So there does, for whatever reason, there does sound to be a little bubbling anxiety at least that's going on beneath the surface here. I think it's really positive that she has told her parent and that you've responded. I think what I would do straight away at home is I would say to her, look, you talk to me about this. Sit down and tell me the story in as much detail as you can. Like, what goes through your head before you do it? What might happen if you weren't to do it? If you were to just go into bed, get her to do the what ifs with you. What's the worst thing that could happen here? And then to say to her, OK, let's catch that thought. Have we evidence for it? You know, is it real? Yeah. Is there any evidence for it? Is it something that we can let go of together? Let it go. So you're getting her to kind of catch herself in the moment and go, I'm having this thought or this worry. I don't think it's real because I have no evidence for it. This is something I can talk about with my parents and then I can let it go. That's a good practice. I would get her outdoors and moving. I would increase sensory play, even though she's 11. I'd look at what movement-based activity she has. I'm thinking if you happen to live near a swimming pool or something, that you can bring her swimming, get her in. That's a very sensory experience that also incorporates movement and activity. I think something like that could be very, very good for her. But I think it would be no harm to check in with a therapist. I do wonder, though, just for this parent to try this and try something more than once, because the first time you try something new, the chances are you're going to be met with resistance. So try it maybe 3, 4, 5 times. But to stay with her, just chatting with her as she's getting ready to get into bed, and stay with her right up until the point she's in the bed. So you're there for when she would normally be doing her routine. And you're just distracting her with chat and connection and maybe talking about different things or singing a song together. Get her into the bed. Stay maybe up to 30 seconds just so she's in the bed, and then leave. Now, look, she may need to get up and do her routine when you leave the room.
Yeah.
But you are doing some delay in on that, and to see, can you short circuit that impulse for her? Because it is like, it's a habit. It's also a compulsive behavior that she's having. So I think it would be no harm, though, to reach out to somebody for some help.
Yeah. Because she does say that there's tics and habits and squinting. So this is happening outside of just bedtime.
It is. It's happening during the day. It does seem the routine itself that this little one has is the bedtime piece.
Yeah.
And if you can break that first and then see if there's a knock-on effect, or because it is also at, during the daytime, though, that's why I'm emphasising the need for the therapist.
Yeah. Okay. Might this be likely come from a single source of anxiety or just generalized anxiety?
It can. I mean, it can for both of those, to be honest with you. It can be, you know, in the absence, because this parent is clearly racking their brains going, where has this come from? I've no idea where to start. It can be there's been an event. It can be anticipation. I'm thinking, you know, this is going on for, well, a few months now. So that would have been the end of school into the summer. We would always look at school environment factors for children this age, because school is such a huge part of their life, as well as activities and peer group stuff, if there's nothing going on at home. But ending 1 year, and I'm just doing the maths, maybe she's going into fifth year or fifth class or coming out of it.
Yeah.
You know, there's a transition coming as well. So maybe it's about, I don't know what teacher I'm going to have, or I do know what teacher I'm going to have.
Yeah.
Going into a new class, and maybe friendships are changing. It could be all of that. And it also could be that she's also pre-adolescent and puberty is in the mix with all of this. So there could be a whole lot going on that she's not quite understanding.
God, yeah. A lot coming down the path very quickly. My four-year-old girl hit another girl her age in creche in an argument over a toy. She managed to cause an injury. The child was bleeding, had to go home and have a cut glued. She has never, ever hit at home or had any issue with this before in creche. I don't know what the best way to approach it with her is. I tried to speak to her that we don't have to express frustration and anger. We decided she would say sorry to the girl and give her a card, which she was happy to do. She says she feels sorry and is sad she hurt the girl. Is there anything else to do? I don't want to go on and on about it and make a big deal of it, but it feels like a big deal.
I mean, you have dealt with it.
Yeah.
Like, this has been dealt with. You know, it happened. You all got a fright. I would argue both parents got a fright, you know, involved both sets of parents in this. You spoke with her. You suggested the card. She was happy to do it. She handed her card. She said sorry. She's told you she feels sad that she hurt. For a four-year-old, Sean, that's really all you can do.
Yeah.
And things move on very quickly in the world of preschoolers. You know, you could cause this injury 1 week, and then 2 weeks later the two of them want a play date, or they're sitting holding hands and playing. So as the grown-ups, we're the ones who often hang on to it and go, oh my gosh, I don't want this to happen again. And I'm sure nobody wants this to happen again. But it does sound like it was a very impulsive action.
Yeah.
You know, I want the toy, you've the toy, we're battling over the toy, and a lashing out, very impulsive. It hasn't happened before, and it sounds like it hasn't happened since. I don't say this now to go, therefore it doesn't matter. It clearly matters, because a serious injury was caused. But I also think that impulsivity and four-year-olds go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is really part of development. I think you could practice a lot of positive expressions of frustration and anger at home if, as a parent, you are looking for what else can I do to kind of, as best as any of us can, future-proof against a repeat of this. And a lot of it is when you're, you know, to role play with her at home. It's my toy. No, I'm happy.
Yeah.
Repeat it and then hit the pause button and say, you're getting cross. What are you going to do? She could go tell a grown up. She could go walk away. She could go to the corner of the room and stamp her feet 6 times, random number, whatever you want yourself. Just give her something to count, you know, whatever number she can count to. Stamp her feet. She can wiggle and shake her body and shake her cross feelings out. But give her a number of things to experience with you in a safe, controlled way.
Yeah.
And then repeat that over and over. I've mentioned it not in a while, though, so it's worth saying again, Molly Potter's book, How Are You Feeling? How Am I Feeling? It's one of the, it's either How Are You Feeling or How Am I Feeling? But you will find it if you put Molly Potter and feeling somewhere. And it's a lovely little picture book for kids at this age and older, where you find your feeling, and it has 4 or 6 pictures of things you can do when you feel that feeling.
Yeah.
So instead of what not to do, it's very much, hey, all feelings are valid. Here's what you can do when you feel this way. I think this little one would just need to know, because frustration over sharing toys and creche, that's definitely going to happen again. What we don't want is that she clobbers another child with the toy, and she has these alternatives, but she's four, so let's manage expectations.
Yeah, I suppose the fact that there was blood drawn makes it seem
and
much
glue
worse.
Stitch. And I mean, it was significant, and I've no doubt parents were met with and spoken to and the kids, but the children have likely, I would say, moved on. I don't want to speak for the other child, but this little one probably has at this stage. And she did feel sad and sorry that it happened. I think for a four-year-old to be showing regret is something really positive.
I
would say it was impulsive, and work on alternative expressions so long as it doesn't happen again.
Yeah. My mother-in-law is currently in palliative care. Her illness has absolutely devastated us, and I'm so worried as to how to deal with this next phase of our lives. She was a super involved grandmother, and I know the kids will be distraught. Our oldest is 8, her youngest is 4. They know she's sick, and I think the 8-year-old has a good understanding that Granny won't be coming home, but I just want to prepare them if I can. How do I explain that Granny is very sick and soon there will be a funeral? How much should I tell them, or how much should I protect them?
Oh, it's a lot. Do you know what? It's a lot for everyone in the family, because, you know, that line there that her illness has absolutely devastated us. I think that's the bit that really jumps out at me, Sean, that as parents, as adults, we can't underestimate our own grief. And it can be very easy to fall into this piece of, oh, I've got to think about the kids and focus on the kids. The best thing you will do for your kids is focus on yourself and really give yourself permission to feel how you're feeling. This is a sad and scary time, and it is an absolute loss of control because you can't stop it. And it brings up all of those feelings, even when you know there's good care happening. We know this is a terminal illness. We know an end is coming. It won't make it less awful when the end happens. And I think just really making space and time for yourselves, because she is clearly a very active part of family life.
Yeah.
The best approach is not dissimilar to how this parent has literally written it to us, is to talk to them honestly in very clear messaging, no ambiguous language, no vague terminology, passing away, going, none of that. You will have to say to them, particularly your 8-year-old, sadly, Granny's life will end soon.
Yeah.
And her body.
And should it be the same amount of information to the 8-year-old and the 4-year-old, given that she feels the 8-year-old already knows?
Yeah. And I think because if you feel the 8-year-old knows, that 8-year-old absolutely knows. But don't assume they know everything in the right way.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
You know, so I think it is very important to sit with the 8-year-old separately, because developmentally they're very different.
Yeah.
And to say, you know, tell me what you know. What's the story you're telling yourself about Granny? Mm. And then I'm going to tell you the story about Granny, but do it together in a shared storytelling.
Yeah.
And be very clear, you know, yeah, you're right. Unfortunately, Granny is the kind of sick that isn't going to get better. And now what everybody wants is that she's comfortable and she's not in pain, but her life is going to end. And we're very sad about it, because it's very sad. But we will always have our love for Granny. We will always have our memories. And then the concept of funeral is a very personal one for families, okay? Because you've an 8-year-old and a 4-year-old. Do they both want or need to be there? That's entirely a parental decision, to be honest. There is no right or wrong. 4-year-olds might struggle with it. There's a lot of grown-ups they know who will be visibly upset and distressed. Children don't always like to see their grown-ups crying. It can be confusing and overwhelming. Some children really benefit from the closure that being at a funeral can give them. Either way, you can acknowledge all of this, and they can be as much a part of a funeral. And explaining to them a funeral is a celebration of somebody's life, but it does bring up lots of feelings about how much we're going to miss that person. So people will laugh and they will smile and they will share good stories and they will cry, and all of that will happen at the same time, so that they have a picture of it. They could, speaking of pictures, you could and maybe should, especially with the 4-year-old, but have both of them draw a beautiful picture that can go into the coffin with Granny and that they're giving it to Granny, even if they're not going to the funeral, that they can still be symbolically a part of it.
Yeah.
You could have them write a little wish that can be incorporated into the mass ceremony, or if you're celebrating her life in that context or however you're doing it, to give them a little role that makes them a part of it as much as they and you are comfortable managing on this. There is no right or wrong. I think when it comes to funerals of close family members, we're all just trying to get through it.
Yeah.
So you might look back afterwards a year later and go, oh, looking back, I would have done this. But you absolutely wouldn't at the time. You did the best you could at the time.
Yeah. If, because, you know, sometimes people are in palliative care, so we know it's the last stage. But that can can be a few weeks. That can be a year's time kind of thing. So telling a 4-year-old now, a 4-year-old might go, you said she was going to die.
I would just say she's very, very sick, and it's the kind of sick that won't get better. So she's in a special place where they're taking care of her.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's where my story would end right now, because 4-year-olds are quite concrete and quite literal. The 8-year-old, you would go into the extra detail. With a 4-year-old, you would leave it at that. A 4-year-old can surprise you now, Sean, as well. They can turn around and go, what does that mean? Is she going to die? If the question is asked, answer it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, but we don't know exactly when, but we do know it's going to happen.
Yeah. The best thing to do is to let the kids spend as much time as possible with their granny and say goodbye in their own way.
As much as is appropriate in palliative care, and seeing what granny's able to manage as well. So, but I agree with that. But again, decorating granny's room, if she's in a nice room, which I'm sure she is, with the kids' drawings and arts, and they send her things, I think that could be lovely.
Yeah. There also might be a slight worry with like sending kids in who've had this chat with mammy, and they might say, they might blurt things out to granny.
Yeah, that just has to be managed very carefully. Yeah.
Our 12-year-old boy is sick of going to summer camps. The trouble is that me and his dad are working full time and have pretty much already used up our annual leave. He's already done 5 weeks of various summer camps. He feels worn out by them. They can get quite repetitive. Is there anything we can do to shake things up for him? I wonder, or are summer camps simply the best structure in place for kids of this age over the summer months? He's a quiet boy and loves nothing more than sitting in an armchair with a book. The summer camps tend to be quite full on and don't always cater for his needs. We feel a bit stuck, and I don't want him to have the feeling he isn't enjoying his summer holidays.
Oh, do you know, I was only talking about this to somebody recently, that July has been the longest summer camp month I can remember.
Yeah.
Because there's 5 weeks. You know, so because you're touching off a bit of June, a bit of August, but there's 5 weeks in July. So I think a lot of families are scratching their head over this one as well. But in the absence of organized, structured childcare, I suppose camps are the best option, is the only answer I can give. Is it the best for your son? I mean, I think he's letting you know, no, I'm over them. I don't want to do any more of these. But I also think, you know, as parents, we have to be able to say to our kids, we don't really have another plan. And I know, and acknowledge it. You know, I would acknowledge the situation to him. I know this isn't what you would choose for your summer. I'm really sorry. You know, I think next summer we'll have to look at a different arrangement. But because we have to work, we really appreciate and thank you for working with us and agreeing to go to camps.
Yeah.
And then if you can, plan for quality time at the weekends that you can spend with him. I'm also, you know, wondering when it comes to camps, and this is my professional and parental hat on, because I do get it, I promise. Like, is it possible? This depends on where you're living. It depends on the hours, because 3-hour camps aren't worth anything to you, you know, when you're a working parent. But is there variety in the type of camp?
Yeah.
Because if it's a lot of high activity camp and you're doing a variation on, you know, GAA, soccer, mixed activities over and over, there's only so often the bouncy castle thing was going to thrill a child at this age.
Yeah.
You know, but if there's a, because I mean, there's all kinds of different camps. We had a couple of really good ones this year that really.
Yeah, but some of them are like very sporty, but like others are like, we're just making it up as we go along. We just give
a little
this
bit
vague
loose.
Name.
There's going to be some activity, but nondescript activity.
Yeah.
And some of them are hyper structured, you know. But if it's a kid who, this kid likes to sit in a chair and read. So if there was something that was maybe a little bit more cerebral, you know. You know, we did a Lego stop motion animation camp this summer, which was a huge hit, and it was in the locality, a huge hit, and it was just a bit different, and you know, appealed in a different way. So now it does a bit late now, says the parent listening. I've already done five, Joanna. But, you know, just thinking of that for a kid who does like more intellectual retreat or books or that, is there something else that he could be doing that isn't just activity-based, just to keep variety there? But I also am wondering, Sean, as parents, like if there is, and there might not be because I don't know what these parents' jobs are, but if there is any scope for flexible working practice, what you could do is spend a morning or an afternoon on your laptop working in the library while he sits in his cozy armchair and reads his book and does exactly what he wants to be doing, but you're still getting work done while you've an eye on him. And he's 12, you know, and there's no mention of other kids. So I'm operating on the assumption we're talking about a 12-year-old here. So, you know, it's really about looking at, okay, I am going to work. Have I any scope to be flexible about where I'm working? And can I just level with him and say, I'm going to sort something out for next year? Childcare is the only other option at this age, though, let's be honest.
Somebody's texted in the controversial question, are the school holidays too long?
I plead the fifth. And I mean,
I feel you're torn in two directions, perhaps, on that one.
I do think that for young children, I've said this about secondary schools in particular, by the way, I think whatever, about 2 months, 3 months is very long when you're too young for a job, which is 13, 14, 15, right up to 16. So it's the whole junior cycle. That is a very long summer to fill, and they won't go to camps for you at that age. I think with primary school, it is a long break for them. I understand from a teacher's perspective that might not feel like that. And, you know, so that's why, I mean, there is two sides. But I think, 8 weeks is a long time to fill for a break.
Yeah. Joanna, thanks a million. As ever, Joanna Fortune there.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.